Mr. Salyer warned me that I wouldn't need that platform, so thanks for that heads up. I'll be trying to look down on my notes. Well, this day has come a lot faster than we thought it would. We knew about 6 months ago that we'd be moving down here to the Houston area, and that seemed like we had a lot of time, but it's come a lot quicker, at least for us. Maybe it hasn't gone so fast for those of you here, but I can definitely say that I understand what the Salyers are experiencing right now, how it can just consume your life to try to take up your roots and relocate to a new place. So definitely appreciate those who have gone before us and done this so many times. I'm just thankful that the church doesn't transfer the ministry as often as they used to. Before beginning with the sermon this afternoon, I just do have to first of all ask for your forgiveness, because I met several of you a couple months ago and I probably remember about a quarter of the names, so I'm sure you'll understand. Also need to ask Mrs. Salyer for forgiveness, because if the house doesn't sell quickly, it's probably because I need the extra mentoring from your husband, so I apologize. Also want to just thank all of you for your prayers along the way. I know Mr. Salyer asked a number of different occasions for you to be praying about our move and our transition. And we really feel like God answered those prayers. We can see the evidence of it all over different situations, which I'll talk about a little bit more in just a few minutes here. Also, thanks for your prayers for the trip down. The girls actually did a lot better than we expected them to. So we left Sunday morning, drove the 19 and a half hours or so, got here by Tuesday afternoon, which was nice to arrive at a decent time of day and be able to get beds set up and get things settled a little bit before our first night in our new home. So we'll pass on our address for our home to Mr. Fauché so he can add that to the local phone book or directory here. All right. Well, I'm thinking about what would be an appropriate topic to speak on this first Sabbath in the area. And honestly, also last week, it's our final Sabbath in Ohio, where we've grown up, where we've lived our entire lives, what I would say to the congregation there as we leave, it's the same thing I want to talk about today, and the first opportunity I have to speak to all of you, the first of many, I'm sure. I want to talk about our move, but not just our move, my wife and I, our family, our trip down here to Houston, but I want to talk about our move as God's people. If you'll turn with me back to Exodus chapter 14, we're going to begin where Mr. Roscoe was in the sermonette as well. We're going to pick up the story in Exodus 14, and we're going to look at one of the greatest relocation stories in the history of mankind. You know, this time of year that you've probably heard several messages, perhaps even part of your personal Bible study was spent reviewing the story of the children of Israel and their departure from Egypt. But I love this type of year, this time of year, and this story, because there are just so many parallels for us as God's people, so many connections between leaving Egypt and us leaving this world, leaving the slavery of Egypt and us departing from the bondage of sin. Pharaoh as the taskmaster and Satan the devil as the taskmaster, the ruler of this world and of this age. So many parallels, so many lessons we can learn. I want to try to draw out another one today in Exodus 14. We're going to pick up the story here of this move, not at the beginning when they started to pack, but here after they had already departed from Egypt in chapter 14. We'll begin in verse 1. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pi Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, opposite Baal Zephon. You shall camp before it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, 'They are bewildered by the land. The wilderness has closed them in.' Then I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them. And I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Eternal." And they did so. Verse 5, now it was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh had and his servants was turned against the people. And they said, "Why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us?" Well, I can think of 10 reasons off the top of my head, and I'm sure you can think of two. Verse 6, so he made ready his chariot and took his people with him. Also he took 600 choice chariots and all the chariots of Egypt with captains over every one of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel. and the children of Israel went out with boldness. So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and overtook them, camping by the sea beside Pi-Hahiroth, before Baal-Zephon. And in verse 10, and when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, because there are no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us, to bring us up out of Egypt? Why did you make us move? We didn't want to leave. Our old landlord wasn't so bad. Now they had a short memory, didn't they? Verse 12, is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. We have this classic story here of Israel lacking faith, already questioning God's motives, his intentions, questioning his ability to protect them, even after all that they had witnessed, even after the 10 plagues that they had witnessed in Egypt. But to cut the children of Israel some slack, they were surrounded on all sides. God intentionally told them, as we just read here in chapter 14, he intentionally told them to camp at this place, where there were mountains on two sides and the sea before them, and now there was this army pursuing them. There was nowhere to go. So I can understand, in a sense, Israel's fear, their lack of faith in this moment. God intentionally told them to put up camp here. Why would he do that? Now, with Pharaoh's army closing in, they were trapped, completely surrounded. We can all probably relate to this spiritually. We've all probably had times when we are truly trying our best to flee from sin, trying to escape the slavery of sin, but we feel trapped. We feel like there's nowhere to go, like we can't escape its pursuit. But God always provides a path. He always provides a path for growth. We pick it up in verse 13, and Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. And the Lord said to Moses, why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward. But lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And I indeed will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. So I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, his chariots and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians shall know that I am the Eternal, when I have gained honor for myself over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen. And the angel of God who went before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud went from before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was a cloud and darkness to the one, and it gave light by night to the other, so that the one did not come near the other all that night. And then finally in verses 21 and 22. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. We're all probably well familiar with this story. God parted the Red Sea and created a path for them to continue on their journey to the Promised Land when they thought there was no path available. But when God parted the waters and he told the Israelites, go forward, move, what would they find in the midst of the sea? When I think about this story, this account that we just read, there are three things that jump out to me that would be present in the midst of the sea. Dry ground, walls of water, and uncertainty. As far as I can tell, the children of Israel had never walked through walls of water before. Their sandals had never touched the bottom of the seabed. They had never looked from side to side and seen walls of water standing upright. They had never seen the depths congealed. But God had created dry ground. A path was made available to them so that they could continue their journey to the promised land. But that path included walls of water, the uncertainty of the unknown. And they had never had to walk through such intimidating circumstances before. But they were simply told, move. Go forward. I imagine that there would have been a lot of courteous people that day who suddenly remembered their manners. I imagine some of them may have said, no, after you. You first, I insist. I mean, think about it. The depths congealed, walls of water. One of the ministers up in Ohio talks about this story often, and he says he just pictures the kids walking along the walls of water with a stick, poking it in every once in a while to see. Is it going to stay? Will the fish swim away when I poke the walls of water? Water's heaped up like a wall, and you want us to walk through there? I mean, imagine what that must have been like. The closest thing I can think of to relate to that is going to an aquarium. There's one at the Feast in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, that has this section that's the shape of a tube or a tunnel, and you literally walk through the waters. You're surrounded by this sea life, and that's scary enough, knowing the construction that went into it, knowing it was tested and proved. But imagine being one of these children of Israel, being told, go forward. Brethren, God always makes a path for us to continue on our journey from the slavery of sin to the promised land of his kingdom. We never reach a point where we're completely trapped, where there's no escape from sin available, even when it looks that way. But the path provided often is not a comfortable one, is it? The path of change, the path of growth, the path of building the character of Jesus Christ is often filled with the uncertainty of the unknown. God miraculously provided a path for Israel's journey to continue, but the circumstances on that path were intimidating. Walls of water surrounded them, clouds above, and the shouts of an army pursuing them, the sound of the horse's hooves getting closer and closer. Now, walking through the Red Sea was new territory, and it was no doubt intimidating and uncertain. And yet they were simply told, move. Go forward. Now, God didn't take the time to explain the physics behind the depths being congealed. He didn't stop and identify which physical laws he would be suspending temporarily, or he didn't provide a timeline for them of how long they would have to cross the sea and be safe. You know, if you make it in the next 32 minutes, you're good. But after that, it might start leaking a little bit. He just told them, go forward. Move. And even though God had miraculously opened the path, he had parted the Red Sea, it still required faith for them to walk, to move, to go forward. We'll see that back here in Hebrews chapter 11, if you'll turn with me. Hebrews chapter 11. We'll read verse 29. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 29. Leading up to this verse, the author of Hebrews is talking about Moses and his faith. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. It continues that Moses, by faith, forsook Egypt. By faith, he kept the Passover. But notice verse 29. By faith, they passed through the Red Sea, as by dry land, whereas the Egyptians, attempting to do so, were drowned. the children of Israel moving forward, walking this path that God had provided for them, required faith. By faith, they passed through the Red Sea. Not by scientific explanation to reduce their anxiety about the situation. Not by understanding ahead of time the ins and outs of how it would all work out. They had to walk through the waters of the unknown, not by perfect understanding, but by faith. And we have to do the same. We're told to walk by faith, not by sight. The walls of water, the uncertainty of the unknown, might be different for each of us here in this room. It might be financial uncertainty. How am I ever going to be able to provide for my family if I can't work on the Sabbath? And if I'm expected to tithe? The path of the unknown might be health uncertainty. And will I ever be freed from this chronic illness? Will I ever feel good again, energized, healthy? Will the cancer return? It might be uncertainty about relationships. Will our marriage survive? Will I ever get married if I don't date outside the faith? Will that friendship I have ever be healed that's been fractured? It might be uncertainty about overcoming sin. Will I ever really be able to beat this sin? Will it ever completely be eradicated from my life? Or it might be uncertainty about our abilities. Hypothetically, can I even do this job? Who am I to be asked to do it? How am I supposed to shepherd God's people? This is all hypothetical, of course. Brethren, on the path of change, of growth, of service, of building the character of Jesus Christ as we journey toward the promised land of God's kingdom, uncertainty will be present. That's a fact. It can be counted on. But there's something else that was also present in the midst of the Red Sea when Israel crossed. Something that's present for us as well, that can make the instruction to move, to go forward on this path to the kingdom, a little less intimidating. We find that in Psalm 77, if you'll turn back there with me now. It may seem like an odd place to find a description of something else that was present in the midst of the Red Sea. But here in Psalm 77, Asaph was writing about the wonders of old, things that God had done in the past to be there for his people. And in Psalm 77, if we pick it up in verse 14, we read Asaph's words here, "You are the God who does wonders. You have declared your strength among the peoples. You have with your arm redeemed your people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph, Selah. The waters saw you, O God." In verse 16, "The waters saw you. They were afraid. The depths also trembled. The clouds poured out water. The sky sent out a sound. Your arrows also flashed about. The voice of your thunder was in the whirlwind. The lightnings lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was in the sea, your path in the great waters, and your footsteps were not known. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron." Now, if we read verses 19 and 20 again in the New International Version, I think that's helpful for us to understand what Asaph was saying here. NIV says, "Your path led through the sea, your way through the mighty waters. Though your footprints were not seen, you led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron." I just love that phrase, "though your footprints were not seen, you led your people through." Brethren, in the present in the midst of the Red Sea was not only dry ground, walls of water, and uncertainty. The unseen footprints of God were there too. God was leading his people through the uncharted waters, through the unknown. Though his footprints were not seen, he was right there with them every step of the way. growth sometimes involves walking through uncharted waters for us as well. It involves stepping out of our comfort zone in faith, trusting that what God has in mind for us is for our good and is better than anything we could think up for ourselves and our lives on our own. But no matter how difficult the path or how insurmountable the obstacles may seem, or how intimidating the circumstances, we have to remember that we aren't called to walk alone. And the point I want to make in this message today is pretty simple, but I think it's an important way to start out our time here in Houston, and important for all of us to think about individually. The simple point I want to make today is that God doesn't just part the Red Sea and provide a path for us to journey toward his kingdom. He walks the path with us. He doesn't just part the waters and expect us to do it on our own. He walks the path with us. So this isn't a sermon about us moving, about my family and I moving. At least that's not all that it's about. This is a sermon about our move collectively as God's people. This is a sermon about Christianity. It's a sermon about change. It's a sermon about our path to the kingdom. God calls all of us to walk a path that includes the unknown at times. But he doesn't ask us to walk it alone. When he says, move, go forward, he goes with us. Let's turn back to Isaiah chapter 43. Now, there are many different references in God's word that we could turn to make this point today. This one here in Isaiah 43 is one of my favorites. Isaiah chapter 43, we're going to read the first three verses. And I'll give you a chance to turn there because us northerners talk fast sometimes. Isaiah 43, beginning in verse 1, says, "But now, thus says the Eternal, who created you, O Jacob, and he who formed you, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by your name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And through the rivers, they shall not overflow you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, nor shall the flame scorch you. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior." Notice it didn't say here, if you walk through the waters, if you walk through the rivers, if you walk through the fire, I'll be with you. It said when. And we will all have to pass through waters of uncertainty, sometimes even leading to anxiety. We will have to walk through the trials of this life, the fire. But when we do, he'll be with us. It said here in verse 2, when you pass through the waters, I will be with you. We have a very vivid example of that in Daniel chapter 3. Let's turn back to the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 3. And we'll read at least a portion of a familiar story here about three faithful men. In Daniel 3, of course, we're reading the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We're going to pick it up in verse 13. But leading up to this point, of course, Nebuchadnezzar the king had made an image of gold. And when the music played, signaling that all the people in the land were to bow down and worship the image and worship him, in a sense, everyone was supposed to fall to their knees. But we'll pick it up in verse 13. "Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, 'Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? Now, if you are ready at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good.'" You know, maybe you just didn't recognize the tune. I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt here. This time, when you hear this music, this is the signal. I'll give you a chance here to bow down and worship me. You know, maybe he told them which track it's going to be. When you hear Johnny Cash's Ring of Fire, that's when you need to bow down. Here's your chance. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. We don't even have to take time to stop and think about this one. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. When I read verses 17 and 18, I see incredible faith. But I also recognize that this was a time of uncertainty. You know, these three men said, we know what God's capable of. We know he's able to deliver us if he chooses to do that. But if not, we're still going to be faithful to him. They didn't know what God was going to allow them to go through. They didn't know for sure if he would intervene and deliver them from the furnace, or whether their deliverance would come when they were brought back to life in the future. But either way, they were going to remain faithful. It's a time of uncertainty. If we continue in verse 19, it says, then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments, and were cast in the midst of the burning fiery furnace. They had lots of flammable attire on so that they would catch fire quickly. Verse 22, therefore, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. God didn't intervene before they were cast in. He allowed them to go through the waters, the fire, the trials, the uncertainty. Verse 24, then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished. And he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, did we not cast 3 men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said to the king, true, O king. Look, he answered, I see 4 men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the form of the 4th is like the Son of God. Now those words in Isaiah 43 ring true right here in this account. That when we walk through the waters, through the fire, I will be with you. God literally was in this case. He appeared in the fiery furnace with these 3 faithful men. Not only were they protected, but he was in their midst. He was at the lead. He was with them. When we step out in faith, in obedience, following God's lead in our lives, he'll be with us too. Even if the circumstances are things that we can't see how we'll ever survive, even when we can't see an escape, he'll be with us. Let's turn back to Deuteronomy 31 as well for another very clear reference to this truth. In Deuteronomy chapter 31, we'll read verse 6. This is coming on the heels of Moses going up on Mount Sinai to receive the Ten Commandments, to receive the tablets that the Ten Commandments were written on. And while he was away, of course, the children of Israel decided to lead themselves. They decided to do their own thing, to take their own approach to what obedience and worship should look like. Verse 6, actually I think I gave you the background on a wrong reference. We'll come to that other situation a little bit later. Verse 6 in Deuteronomy chapter 31, this is when God's giving them instruction about when they go into the land, about how they will overtake the land and the nations in those areas that would become the promised land. And in verse 6, he says, "Be strong and of good courage. Do not fear nor be afraid of them. For the Eternal, your God, he is the one who goes with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you." I don't know how much more clearly God can say it to us. He is the one who goes with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. Walking away from this world, from its ways of thinking and behaving, from the slavery of sin, from its taskmaster, requires a miracle in our lives. God has to be the one to deliver us. He has to be the one to part the Red Seas and provide the path for us. He allows trials and tests and discomfort, though, on that path. But he's there. He goes forward with us into the unknown. Unless we don't really want him to. You know, there's a contingency to all of this. There's a contingency to the fact that God will be with us, that he'll walk with us through the waters, through the fire. We have to want him to be. All of these clear scriptures about God not leaving us on our own to face these trials, these tests, these challenges, these uncertainties, they're contingent on one thing: our desire to be led by him, our willingness to be led by him. If we seek his lead and submit to it in faith, then we can be confident that he'll be with us. If we turn over to Exodus 33, Exodus chapter 33. Now we're in the context of this situation when Israel made the golden calf. They decided to worship God their own way. They decided to take the lead of their own lives. Verse 1 of chapter 33, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Depart and go up from here, you and the people whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt, to the land of which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, to your descendants I will give it. And I will send my angel before you, and I will drive out the Canaanite, and the Amorite, and the Hittite, and the Perizzite, and the Hivite, and the Jebusite. Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey, for I will not go up in your midst, lest I consume you on the way, for you are a stiff-necked people.' And when the people heard this bad news, they mourned, and no one put on his ornaments. For the Lord had said to Moses, 'Say to the children of Israel, you are a stiff-necked people. I could come up into your midst in one moment and consume you. Now therefore, take off your ornaments, that I may know what to do to you.'" So these verses here tell us God going with us, him being with us as we go forward, that's contingent on us, on our willingness to follow his lead. He was still going to fulfill his promise here to the children of Israel. He said, "Go up into the land, you'll possess it, but I'm not going with you." As a parent, I can relate to verse 3 here probably a little bit more than I should be able to, because perhaps you understand those times as well when you tell your children, "Just go away from me, because if I'm around you right now, I'm going to hurt you." He said, "Go up, but I'm not going with you. You don't really want to be led by me, so I'm not going with you." But if we drop down to verse 12, it says, "Then Moses said to the Lord, 'See, you say to me, bring up this people, but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. Yet you have said, I know you by name, and you have also found grace in my sight. Now therefore I pray, if I have found grace in your sight, show me now your way. Show me the dry ground that you've provided. Show me now your way, that I may know you, and that I may find grace in your sight. And consider that this nation is your people.'" In verse 14, "And he said, 'My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest.' Then he said to him, 'If your presence does not go with us, do not bring us up from here. For how then will it be known that your people and I have found grace in your sight, except you go with us? So we shall be separate, your people and I, from all the people who are upon the face of the earth.' So the Lord said to Moses, I will also do this thing that you have spoken, for you have found grace in my sight, and I know you by name." God changed his mind here because of Moses' humble approach, Moses' desire to be led by God. You know, these words in verse 15 of Moses, "If your presence does not go with us, do not bring us up from here." These are words I can connect with because it's exactly how I felt about our move here. If your presence doesn't go with us, do not bring us up from here. I remember Mr. Myers, who was my mentor back in Ohio, about 2 years ago now, this time of year, probably right exactly 2 years ago, he asked me the question, "Have you ever thought about serving in the ministry?" And I said, "Yeah, I've thought about it a lot. And I've concluded that I'm completely incapable and would never be able to do the job." And he said, "Good. If you said anything else, I'd be worried about you. That's how you should feel. But there's someone who goes with you. That's the only reason why I'm here, is believing this. Believing that if God opens the path, he'll go with us." Psalm 46, verse 1 says, "God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble." A very present help. Not, "I'm there sometimes. If you really need me, I'll step in." He's our refuge, our strength, a very present help in trouble. The rest of the psalm goes on to say, "Though the mountains shake in the heart of the sea, though the waters roar and foam, we will not fear, because we know God's with us." So God will be with us if we want him to be. But the truth is, we might question that at times. In fact, the description we read in Psalm 77 by Asaph about how God led Israel through the Red Sea, even though his footprints were not seen, these words of Asaph came after he experienced some of the same type of questioning. Let's go back there and read about it. Psalm 77, we'll begin in verse 1 this time. Psalm 77, once again. "To the chief musician, to Jeduthun, a psalm of Asaph. I cried out to God with my voice, to God with my voice, and he gave ear to me. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. My hand was stretched out in the night without ceasing. My soul refused to be comforted. I remembered God and was troubled. I complained and my spirit was overwhelmed. Selah. You hold my eyelids open. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. I have considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. I call to remembrance my song in the night. I meditate within my heart, and my spirit makes diligent search." Verse 7, "Will the Lord cast off forever? And will he be favorable no more? Has his mercy ceased forever? Has his promise failed forevermore? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his tender mercies?" And I said, "This is my anguish." I'm feeling kind of down about this today, God. Yeah, I'm kind of blue today. This is my anguish. But, middle of verse 10, "I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the works of the Eternal. Surely I will remember your wonders of old. I will also meditate on all your work and talk of your deeds. Your way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Who is so great a God as our God? You are the God who does wonders. You have declared your strength among the peoples. You have with your arm redeemed your people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph." And he continues with those verses we read earlier. about God delivering his people through the Red Sea, though his footprints were not seen. When we consider the whole psalm here, we see that Asaph was in anguish. He was questioning God's presence with him, questioning God's love. But he didn't stay in anguish. He turned his mind to the years of the Most High. He looked at the history of God's involvement with his people, of God's involvement with him personally, perhaps, as well. And he concluded that though God's footprints were not seen, he had led his people through. And I think we could safely speculate here that Asaph concluded that even though he was in anguish and he couldn't see the footprints of God, he knew God would lead him through too. Now, it's true that God's footprints are sometimes unseen. Sometimes we look around our lives and our circumstances, and it could be easy to fall into anguish, like Asaph, and think, "Where are you, God?" But it's during those times of questioning and doubt that we have to remind ourselves, like Asaph did here, that although God's footprints are not always seen, he is always with us when we want him to be, when we submit to his lead. In the times when that becomes cloudy in our minds, we have to look to the clear examples of history, like Asaph did. We have to remember the wonders of old, the times in the history of God's people, in Scripture, when God's presence was with them. But we have to remember the times in our own lives when God's presence with us was undeniable. We could classify those as parting of the waters moments. And when we're feeling like we're questioning if God is really going with us or not, we have to remember those clear times. I hope you all have some of those stored up in your minds. Those times when you could see the footprints of God on a certain situation, when you knew beyond the shadow of a doubt that he was involved, that he was leading you. I have several of those. I'm sure I'll share many of them with you along the way, but there are quite a few that relate to our children. We didn't think we'd ever have any. And now those crying babes in the back belong to us. Others, those clear moments when I felt like God's footprints were clear, they could be seen, have to do with us ending up here, serving in the ministry. And even this move itself. You know, Mr. Salyer mentioned that we put our house up and sold it within a couple days. The process of getting your house ready to list is not fun. I worked in real estate for 4 years before I started working for the church. I worked with an investor who, we bought an average of 52 houses a year. And he renovated half of them and sold the other ones to other gentlemen and crews who were trying to do the same thing, renovate houses. So I guess you could say that should have helped me with finding a house, but it was also kind of a plague too, because that means I always want a good deal. It's hard to find a good deal sometimes when you have a limited amount of time to find a place. But on the end of selling our home, it was one of these times where I felt like God's footprints could be seen. If there was any hesitancy on our part saying, if your presence doesn't go up with us, then we don't want to go from here, some of these footprints helped nudge us along the way. We put our house on the market on a Friday afternoon. It went on the market live about 2 p.m. And in the showing instructions, we said no showings between sunset Friday, sunset Saturday. About 40 minutes after it was listed, we got our first showing request for 4 o'clock that day, because they didn't want to have to wait until Sunday. And then we had 4 showings set up for Sunday and 2 more for Monday. And by Monday morning, before even all those showings were able to take place, we had 2 full price offers on our house. The funny part is, since I worked in real estate, the agent that we had list our house was someone I had worked with for the last few years. And I knew he was kind of on the conservative side, but I also trust his opinion on what you could be able to sell a house for. And I had him come over several months ago and take a look at the house, tell me what we needed to fix. And I asked him, what would be a good sell first weekend price for our house? If we just want it to be done and move on. And he said, $89,900. I know that's probably shocking in Houston, so that also helps you understand the sticker shock we're having living here. He said, but you could probably list it at $99,900, but I wouldn't go over $100,000. And I said, all right, well, check these out. So what about these three houses that have sold, you know, for $120,000, $123,000, all within a quarter mile of here? So I'd really like to try it at $119,900 and just see what happens. And I remember telling Emily privately that we want to at least give God the opportunity to bless us with a little extra if he'd like to make our transition down to Houston a little easier. But with the understanding that if we didn't get any action in the first couple of weeks, we would drop the price. And in 2 days, we had two full price offers. The one we accepted was a cash offer, which means no worries about appraisal issues or about the financing falling through. I was still a little bit hesitant because our house was 97 years old. So when it came time to do the home inspection the very next morning, actually, I was a little nervous waiting to see the long list of repairs that they would ask us for. And I got a text message from a lady who assists the agent that we used, that I also used to work with. And she said, I just sent over the release of all contingencies. They did the home inspection and they said they'll take it as is. Full price, cash offer, as is, no repairs. And oh, by the way, they want to close in 11 days. And then they'll let you live in the house for another 30 days after that rent free, because they know you have to find a place still. But they want you to choose their offer so much that they're willing to close and own the house and let you live in it for another month. You know, to us, these were footprints, evidence of God's involvement, encouragement along the way. And when I was relaying some parts of this story to my sister-in-law, she said, wow, it's like you're experiencing your very own parting of the Red Sea. So this message kind of should be credited back to her. That's true. That's how we felt. And the miracles really continued after that, too. The night before we were supposed to close on the sale of our house, even though we'd be living in it for another month, the night before we were supposed to close, a tornado came through the area and knocked our neighbor's pine tree down across the street. And it fell across the street and landed right in front of our driveway. If it had fallen at a slightly different angle, it would have been on top of our garage with both of our vehicles inside. And I know this is perhaps not the way it worked, but I can just imagine Satan thinking, all right, I've got one for you. And as the tree was falling, I imagine God saying, nope. And God parted the waters. We really believe that. But when the footprints of God's presence are less evident in our lives, when the times of uncertainty come, we have to look to these times of clarity and remember what God has done for us. Because if he parted the waters, will he not also lead us through them? And does it make any sense at all that if he opens up an opportunity for growth, for change, for character development, for service, that he'll not also give us the help we need to lead us through that opportunity? Romans chapter 8. Like I said earlier, the path of uncertainty that we each face is different for every individual in this room. But the fact that God will be with us along that path is the same. Romans 8, we'll begin in verse 31. Romans 8:31, what then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things? God initiated our journey on the path to his kingdom in the most miraculous, loving way that we can imagine. He sent his son to die in our place, to open the path of forgiveness, of growth, of change, that ultimately leads to becoming members of his family. And Paul writes here, if he did that, if he gave his son to initiate that process, how will he not also freely give us all things that we need along the way to complete that journey? Verse 33, who shall bring a charge against God's elect? It is God who justifies. Who is he who condemns? It is Christ who died, and furthermore is also risen, who is even at the right hand of God, who also makes intercession for us. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation, or distress, or persecution, or famine, or nakedness, or peril, or sword? Shall the walls of water, the trials, the unknown, the uncertainty? These things can only separate us from the love of Christ if we let them. Verse 37, yet in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am persuaded that neither death nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other created thing shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. We can't be separated from him because he's there with us, walking the path that he's created. And Philippians 1, verse 6 says, he who has begun a good work in you will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ. He's not going to quit early. It says he will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ. He's not going to stop a day early, a year early, a month early. He's going to finish the work that he started in us. If he opened up the path of growth, of change, of character building, to ultimately lead us into his kingdom, he's going to finish what he started. Let's turn back to Exodus 15 as we bring this to a close. Exodus 15. We're not going to finish the rest of the story of Israel passing through the Red Sea in chapter 14. I think you're well familiar with that. If not, you can feel free to go back and read it this week. But we're going to pick it up in Exodus 15, which is this song of celebration after the children of Israel were delivered from Pharaoh and his army. Exodus 15, verse 1. Then Moses and the children of Israel sang this song to the Lord and spoke, saying, I will sing to the Eternal, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and its rider he has thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. He is my God, and I will praise him, my father's God, and I will exalt him. In verse 8, and with the blast of your nostrils, the waters were gathered together. The floods stood upright like a heap. The depths congealed in the heart of the sea. Verse 11, who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like you, glorious in holiness, fearful in praises, doing wonders? You stretched out your right hand. The earth swallowed them. You, in your mercy, have led forth your people, the people whom you have redeemed. You have guided them in your strength to your holy habitation. Down to verse 16. Fear and dread will fall on them, speaking of the nations around who hear about this. By the greatness of your arm, they will be as still as a stone, till your people pass over, O Lord, till the people pass over whom you have purchased. You will bring them in and plant them in the mountain of your inheritance, in the place, O Lord, which you have made for your own dwelling, the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established. The Eternal shall reign forever and ever. Now, this is a song of celebration about the physical deliverance of the children of Israel. But these are words that we look forward to singing one day as well, when our passing through the Red Sea is completed, when we're able to sing and say, you have brought us into the land, the mountain of your inheritance. You have led your people. And when Israel left Egypt, God provided them with a path that no one could have ever foreseen. When God parted the Red Sea, the Israelites were walking into the unknown. But they had to trust that they weren't walking alone. In the midst of the walls of water, the clouds above, the armies of Egypt hot on their heels, through the unknown, through the intimidating path, God was at the lead. Though his footprints were not seen, he was the one leading them through the uncharted waters, guiding their every step. And when we yield our lives to the will of the Father, to his lead and direction, we can trust that he'll be with us on our path the same way. We can trust that God never sends us where he hasn't already been. This is a quote that was on a card I was given by the Myers when I was first hired for the church. God never sends you where he hasn't already been. Now, though we might be uncertain or even intimidated at times by the path of growth that God has planned for us, he's already been there. He's the one who dried up the ground. He heaped up the waters, and he'll see us through. Though the path will come with its challenges, trials, uncertainties, the directive for us is the same as it was for Israel. Move. Go forward. And we can follow that directive with confidence because we know that we're not called to go forward alone. Believing that God goes with us is what sustains us. It's what strengthens us to be able to walk by faith and not by sight. It's what keeps us going as we continue to flee from sin, as we continue to strive to change and grow. It's what gives us the courage to say yes when we're asked to serve in ways that we know we're not capable of on our own. And honestly, it's the understanding, the belief that God goes with us. That's the only thing that's kept me from pulling a Jonah about a week ago before it was time to move to Houston. Just like God parted the Red Sea for Israel, God is opening opportunities for each of us to learn, change, serve, and grow as we walk toward his kingdom. Though his footprints aren't always seen, he is leading his people through. So let's never forget that. Let's look for the evidence of his presence in our lives, and let's obey God's charge to move, to go forward wherever he leads. Because God doesn't just part the Red Sea and open a path for us to his kingdom. He leads his people through. Will we follow him? The time has come to move. So let's go forward.